The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. I start with that because I am by nature a fox. I like knowing many things. I try not to let a day pass without acquiring some useful bit of knowledge. By inclination, I'm a hedgehog. I'd much rather know one big thing. In my guise as a fox, I find myself a non-theist. In my guise as a hedgehog, I think I'm a theist. This puts me in an embarrassing position sometimes, because when I'm amongst theists, which tends to be within my local meeting and my area meeting, I feel myself to be a non-theist. But when I first attended a non-theist conference several years ago, I found myself to be much more of a theist than I thought. So where I am seems to depend on the circumstances. This dualism, duality, I found only resolved when, about age 40, they combined into a focused image, and that was about the same time that I joined the Religious Society of Friends. I want to say here and now that I'm not trying to persuade you of anything, or to argue for anything, or to say this is what we as Quakers should be doing or should not be doing, or believing or not believing. I just want to explain how I came to this peculiar position, in the hopes that at least it will resonate with at least one other friend within this virtual meeting room. So I'll start with the hedgehog side. I went to a Church of England primary school at about the age of 7. It was associated with a church, and at the school, obviously, we did quite a lot of Bible reading, and I became quite accustomed to the language of the Bible, and I enjoyed Bible stories. I still do venerate the Bible, except that nowadays, the older I get, the more I find myself in tune with the Old Testament rather than the New Testament. In fact, if it means anything to you, my favourite book of the Bible is Ecclesiastes. When I went to secondary school, I went to a school which happened to have quite a strong Christian ethos, and I also at that time started going to church with a friend of mine, and I was sufficiently interested in my childhood knowledge of the Bible to wish to continue with religious knowledge as an extra, which I took as an extracurricular subject for O-level GCEs. I even started confirmation classes, but that didn't last very long. I think what put me off and actually caused me to, so to speak, walk away from the church was an unfortunate experience that I had in 1955 with the Billy Graham Crusade in London, which left me feeling that I had been conned. And ever since then, I've had great difficulty in coping with evangelicalism, which can be embarrassing sometimes because my wife is an evangelical. And she joined the Baptist Church a few years ago and underwent total immersion for that purpose. So that was that side. That was the hedgehog side. Now for the fox side. The other book, or series of books, just as the Bible is not a book, but a series of books, which meant a lot to me, was the Arthur Mee's Children's Encyclopedia, of which I'd probably read all 10 volumes within the space of a couple of years. It covered a wide range of subjects, and the one that particularly appealed to me at the time, and still does indeed, was entitled Earth and Its Neighbours. And it followed through the story of life on Earth. So I became interested in evolution. In fact, it was partly because of my interest in evolution that, I found that it clashed with what I was being taught in church youth club and so on. And because I think this is where the foxy side of me began, liking real things. At the age of 10, and still at primary school, we were introduced to the use of the local public library. And I remember that I was horrified when I first went there to discover that it was divided into two sections called fiction and non-fiction. To my mind, I thought that it should be divided into real books and story books. And what I was most interested in was what I called real books. So this was a fox delighting in knowing many things. As a result of this interest in evolution, I have to say that I became enthused by dinosaurs many years before they became part of the entertainment industry as they are today. And even while I was still at primary school, because I live in London, I was travelling regularly to the Natural History Museum, of which that's the interior behind me in the screenshot, in the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, which I think many of you may know, which has been described as a cathedral of nature. And I was delighted when I discovered later that it had been designed by a Quaker architect. One book that I did discover, a story book, a few years ago, was a book by late 19th century writer Samuel Butler. The book was called Eriwom, which is nowhere backwards, and more or less like Thomas More's Utopia. And I'd like to quote you something from the sequel to that called Eriwom Revisited. In that he says, God is God to us only so long as we cannot see him. When we are near to seeing him, he vanishes, and we behold nature in his place. And at this point, I'm going to change my background, if I can do it conveniently. And here I am now in the wildlife section of the Natural History Museum. I still read widely about evolution, especially anthropology, and I was very much struck by John Richter's recent talk in which he said of himself, I am an earthling. That's exactly how I would describe myself. I very much love this world and this natural world that we live in. Before I go on to explore my understanding of God and theism, I should just mention that I finished my years at school by studying modern languages. In fact, I started my professional life as a language teacher. A language is very important to me. So on that topic of language and meaning, when people say, do you believe in God? They don't usually mean what they say. What they usually mean is, do you believe that God exists? And that doesn't depend on what you mean by God. It depends on what you mean by exist. There are all sorts of things which we take for granted exist when in fact they don't do so. Rainbows, for example. The closer you approach to a rainbow, the more it disappears, just as God does. You could even photograph a rainbow, but it's not there. It doesn't exist in the sense of really existing in the universe somewhere as something. You could say much the same thing about unicorns. Nobody believes that unicorns really exist, but if you asked anyone to describe a unicorn, they would describe it as a white horse with a horn sticking out of its forehead. So there is some sense in which these things exist. God must exist if only because we have a word for God. And it wouldn't be much point in the word developing if we didn't have an idea of God. What I actually believe in is not the existence of God, but the presence of God, which I will try to explain later. When I say I believe in God, I mean that I find the idea of concept of or concept of God significant, helpful, and life-affirming. It's something I put my trust and faith in. It's something that gives me enough self-confidence to go through life. But if you will accept the paradox, the God I believe in is not a really existing one. It's a non-theist God. As Samuel Butler goes on to say in Erewhon, we remove ourselves furthest from God when we invest him with human form and attributes. When I was in my late teens or possibly early 20s, I found myself one day in the Natural History Museum in the old dinosaur gallery, which had a mural on either side of the front door, one depicting life in the Jurassic and one of life in the Cretaceous age. I'm going to try and share a picture with you. I can find where I've put it. There it is. Now, that is not the picture I saw. I had contacted the museum recently, and they haven't got any record of it, but it was more or less like that. And I sat in front of that, and I found myself thinking, where was God when this was going on? How does God fit into this picture? And after a while, I came to the conclusion that if I could enter into this scene, which I very much wanted to do, I would love to have been able to time travel, then God would have been there in the sense that God exists in my heart or in myself. God, as I see it, can only exist by a process of being perceived. That was the explanation I gave myself, and I still find it fairly helpful. Listen again. One evening, at the close of Ramadan, before the new moon rose, I found myself within the potter's shop, with the clay population round about in rows. And strange to say, among that earthen lot, some could articulate and others not. And suddenly one more impatient cried, who is the potter, pray, and who's the pot? That's exactly the question I keep asking myself. Did we invent God or did God invent us? In the early 1980s, I watched on television a program called The Sea of Faith, which many of you may have seen, in which Don Cupid introduced the non-theist idea that we adhere to. And as a result of that, I found myself wondering if I entirely went along with the statement of faith, as it were, by the Sea of Faith, which is that religion is a human creation. I can see that religion is a human creation insofar as religion is a set of ideas and procedures that we work by. But I sometimes wonder whether it's the same as saying that God is a human creation. So what I kept asking myself is, did we invent God or did God invent us? I would say that God is a human creation, or perhaps rather a human experience. In fact, I would think that God is a uniquely human experience. Now, I'm coming back to the Bible for a moment. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. A couple of years ago, I suddenly realized how similar that was to the beginning of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And on pondering that, I realized that both these statements are poetic statements of what I believe really happened in history, in the development of human life and thought. In the beginning was the Word, implies to me that in the beginning was language. It was language, the development of language, that turned us from a superior ape into Homo sapiens, or any one of the other varieties of Homo. So in a sense, that is the beginning of everything. It's the beginning of our history. And having got language, that led to the development of self-consciousness, very much of a subject of great discussion in scientific circles these days. And with self-consciousness, I think, developed the idea of conscience, and therefore the beginning of ethics and morals. But it was language which caused all this to happen. The light is the light of understanding, which includes the recognition of death. Death is the fruit of the tree of knowledge, as it says in the Bible. Tree of knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Or at least, as soon as you develop self-consciousness and consciousness of the world and of others, you realize what it is to die. So I would describe what I have as a sense of godness, which is not so much imparted from outside, or invented consciously by us, but is, as Hugh Rock said in an article a couple of years ago, a built-in or emergent property of being human, as much a product of evolution as of the development of our bodies and minds. To that extent, I see God as a sort of universal potential. I believe and have no way of proving it, so I would like to believe that any advanced civilization on any planet which becomes sufficiently advanced to develop language which takes the mind away from and out of the ordinary time continuum is going to develop an idea of consciousness and an idea of God as well. And that's what I mean by believing in God as a universal potential. One little thought there just struck me. One of the things about that language gives us as an advantage or an improvement over communication between animals, so far as we know, is that animal communication is about the here and now. So far as we know, animals can't think about what happened next week or what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next week or what happened last week. In fact, it brings to mind a joke that was going around when I was a student. There were two hippopotamuses having a mud bath, and one said to the other, "That's funny, I keep thinking it's Tuesday." Well, I can't imagine any animal thinking it was Tuesday. And it's this ability to get away from the here and now that gives us the power of imagination. And from this power of imagination that we develop the idea of God. I'm going to quote our advices and queries, number 7. Be aware of the Spirit of God at work in the ordinary activities and experience of your daily life. Spiritual learning continues throughout life, often in unexpected ways. There is inspiration to be found all around us, in the natural world, in the sciences and arts, in our work and friendships, in our sorrows, as well as in our joys. This is what I understand by the presence of God. It's not thinking that God exists, it's just feeling a sense of Godness, which I get in all sorts of circumstances, in meeting for worship, for example, in nature, especially when I'm walking through woodlands and forests. I get it in a meeting for worship when the meeting becomes centered and we all feel that we are feeling the same sort of presence. I also feel this sense of Godness in a very personal way, in that from the earliest time, probably when I was at primary school, I've always been conscious of a presence which is sort of just round the corner from me. I feel as if there's somebody there accompanying me. And one of the helpful byproducts of this is that I can't empathize with people who feel alone. I never really feel alone. I always feel the presence of God around me. I also feel, in a sense, that I have been guarded and guided. I have lived adventurously. I've taken several significant steps in my life. I left teaching because I couldn't cope with it and I wanted to be a journalist. I became a technical writer. I discovered I had an ability for it. Then later on, when I found an opportunity to join the staff of a magazine called Games and Puzzles, because I've always been very keen on games, I left the technical writing job and became editor of that magazine for a while and a frequent contributor thereafter, and I started inventing games and had them published. I feel all these things have been preordained, whatever it is. They've led me to one of my favourite lines, which is, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. I've also felt guarded in the sense that I've undergone several accidents which could have been fatal in other circumstances. When I was self-employed in the games world for a long time, during the 70s and 80s, it often happened that I found myself short of money for a particular reason, a particularly big bill or something. And almost miraculously, more often than not, I got a sudden influx of money, which just about covered that. So I feel that I have been blessed. In meeting for worship, when I feel called to ministry, I find myself wondering whether this call and what I say is coming from within me or outside me. Is something speaking through me? Is it something supernatural or is it something subconscious? It feels like it coming from the outside, but I'm reluctant to ascribe to the supernatural whatever can be more adequately described as coming from the natural. So I think it must be coming from somewhere within me. And yet, at the same time, I don't feel as if I have any control over it or can take any credit for it. All I can do is feel thankful that it has struck me. Perhaps there's no difference between the inside and the outside, and the two just merge into one another like a Möbius strip. William James discusses this dilemma in the last chapter of his classic work, Varieties of Human Experience, and he comes down as gently as possible on the side of the subconscious. So perhaps that's what it is. But as David Bolton says in his book of that title, The Trouble with God, the trouble with God is that however far you seek to depart from him, he never really goes away. That's, I think, as far as I need to go, but I would, having mentioned my penchant for languages, like to make a plea. I count myself fortunate in having grown up speaking or being able to speak Godspeak, which I can still speak fairly fluently. I'm glad that it has given me a vocabulary in which to express such spiritual insights as I have. And I would be sorry to see that language go. I was not very happy when a non-theist friend rewrote the Advices and Queries in such a way as to completely remove all reference to God and the divine. So I do hope that we can go on using God language where appropriate and where necessary. And the last thing I'll say is to revert to the fox and the hedgehog, which is a fable that goes back about 7,000 years, I think. But one version of the original, and the animals keep changing through the course of time, is that when confronted with danger, the fox knows so many things that he can't choose between them. And he gets caught while he's dithering. But the hedgehog knows one big thing, and that's to curl up in a spiky ball, and the hedgehog thereby saved himself. Thank you, friends.